All right, we're recording. All right, good morning. Yeah, my name is Tom Sloan, and I'm joined
By
by
Maya Ross.
Maya Ross. Can you hear us?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, loud and clear.
Good.
Right on. All
Right,
right.
do you want to cover the 40-minute thing first?
Yeah, so we're out in the free version, so it cuts us off at 40 minutes. But if we decide to go longer, if that's okay with you, we would stop and then start a new one. If that's
Sure, 40 minutes you want to do?
well, I mean, it only lets you do 40 minutes, but if we want to go longer, if it gets to that point, we can start a new call.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I wasn't sure it would go that long. Okay.
If you have that much time, we'll see how what happens.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Go ahead. You want to start it? No. All
Listen.
right, we are talking now on the phone. We are in Zoom, actually, with Bill Janovitz of Buffalo Tom. You're a songwriter, an author, a guitarist. You pretty much do it all. How are you doing this morning?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. I know you've been super busy, and I've been trying to do this. I think I reached out to you first in May of 2019. No, 2021. Yeah, and you were in the middle of the Leon Russell book, I believe. So, thank you for finally taking the time to do this.
Oh yeah, you know, I appreciate it and the interest, but yeah, when you're in something like that, it's hard to sort of break out of it and be. When I'm interviewing others, it's hard for me to like sort of
Right.
break out of that mindset and be interviewed.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I understand. And that must be, and reading the book, I mean, that must have been a pretty intense journey. So I'm sure when you're in that mode, yeah, there's, you can't, no time for other distractions, I'm sure.
Yeah, I was probably getting to be near. I don't know when it was that you reached out to me, but I think it was getting out to be it was getting to be sort of crunch time or just I was sort of grinding through the middle of it anyway. But yeah, it's hard for me to switch brains, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, I understand. And
Now, when you're deep into a project like that, the second for me personally, if I do stop and I go to something else, it's really hard to get back to that place that you were in. So, thank you so much though for being able to do this interview with us today. We greatly appreciate it. Tom and I have both been Buffalo Tom fans for such a long time. I remember when the first album came out. Your debut album was my introduction, and I still to this day don't really know how I found you because the album had just come out. It was probably flipping through stacks when I would go to Columbia Records and at the Columbia store and be flipping through, and the cover of the album was cool, the song titles looked cool, and that drew me in.
Yeah, these are the days, right, where you just sort of went in blind and you say, well, I like this label or whatever that put out all these other bands, so I'll take a chance on this one. I did that a lot with like SST Records, which by the end were not always great, but you know.
In the beginning, though, in the 90s and then the early, in the late 80s, SST was to be trusted.
And so it was a big blessing for us to have our record come out on SST, our first one here in the States. And it was similar over in Europe. You know, we were on certain labels over there that were just, they were in our record collection. And so it meant a lot. It meant a lot. I mean, back in those days, the label meant a great deal aside from just the distribution and marketing. And it was just sort of like a imprimatur to be like, it was sort of a blessing, you know, to be on a certain label.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking that too, because like when you first start a band, you end up your first demo or record, you end up usually putting out yourself. And then your dream is to get on a label. And then you finally do get on a label, and then you want to get on a bigger label to get distribution or better recording and touring and things like that. And but it seems like nowadays all things have come full circle and everybody's putting out their own records again. And labels are just kind of, or people starting their own labels, I guess. Is that the same case for you?
I mean, when people complain about streaming services, what they're really complaining about is the splits, right? And what they're making or what they're not making in the case of most and I absolutely sympathize with that or empathize with it because I'm part of it as well. But you know, like nowadays, what do labels do? What are their functions? You know, like it's we have our own label now. I mean, I loved working with Beggars Banquet, and I love still working with Beggars Banquet, who is our UK label, who we signed to directly in by between our first and second record, and they were pretty much our label for all of those years. They distributed to different. They licensed, I should say, to different labels around the world, including the United States. So we were on major labels in the United States, but we were always really signed to Beggar's Banquet, and they really were a buffer, and they kept us, they kept out of our thing, you know. They were helpful when, like, for example, oh, do you want to hire a guy to mix this record? You know, like, but they were never telling us they didn't hear a hit or what. You know, they didn't really care. I mean, this is a label that was built up on. Well, it was built up on Gary Numan, you know, but who knew Gary Numan was going to have a hit back then? It was, you know, and The Fall and all these great bands that they were putting out. But yeah, nowadays, I mean, there are some great labels that are doing great things. Merge Records, my friends down there, for example. But I don't really see the need for one unless they're really going to sort of give somebody something that a band that they're not, you know, something that they're not going to get otherwise. You know, you can distribute, hire a publicist, whatever, and go that route, which is kind of what we're doing.
So yeah, you've got the new album is going to be coming out very soon. You've released Helmet as a single.
The single comes out
Yeah.
this Friday, right? The
I think so, yeah.
12th.
And you've got a new book coming out. So you've been a very, very busy person in all of this time. Were you working more on the album or more like songs for the album, or are you working more for the book through the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I have a day job. That's really the way I make my money, is selling real estate, you know. So I have to actually turn in and turn up for that job every once in a while. But I got into that. So, you know, back in like 21 years ago, when Buffalo Tom was slowing down or had almost stopped for a while, because it ostensibly offered flexibility to do these kinds of things, and it does. It's just that when it's busy, there's no room to breathe. So I try to structure all these other things. Like now, that business is very quiet in the winter season here. So this is a time for me to really kind of dedicate time to. I'm staring at my car's book ab above the screen now. I'm working on that. Yeah, but. You know, with Buffalo Tom, with these three guys, with these, you know, us three guys, it's a matter of checking in with each other because they're busy too, and Chris and Tom. And so it's a matter of like, well, I got these songs. You want to hear some songs? Should we start thinking about a next record? That kind of thing. We just, you know, it's three grown ass men trying to sort of get on the same page. And it's not, it takes a while. I mean, this one took longer than expected because of the pandemic and just not being able to get into a studio, never mind. I mean, a rehearsal studio, never mind an actual studio. So, but it was a good time to sort of send a bunch of ideas at each other is an interesting choice of words. You know, and then out of that, it's such a different age than when we started, of course. And like, we send around cassettes. Now we just have a Dropbox where we literally just drop things in and say, what do you think of this idea? What do you think of that idea? So yeah, it's a balancing act. It's like spinning plates, right? You know, but I wouldn't have it any other way. Maybe I have a bit of ADD or something, where I just need to be running around like a chicken with my head.
You thrive in chaos.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And the people that I write about, these artists, they're all really driven. When you're, I don't know if you guys are musicians or what, but it's if you're creative, yeah, it's like, even if the music or whatever is going to go into a vacuum, it's like you still need to do it. And like these people that I'm writing about, it's like it's almost like a shark. If you stop, you're going to die, kind of thing. You know, we're all here, and I look at it as like a benefit of I'm healthy, I'm something, whatever, 57 years old, I'm still able to do this. People are still listening to music, people are still reading books. So what else am I gonna do? You know, I'm very fortunate to be able to do it all.
Was this something you always wanted to do? Like when you were younger, Did you want to be a musician, or was there something else that you wanted to do?
I mean, it's sort of like playing out like I had always thought. Like I a musician was, if there's, I didn't really know what I wanted to do aside from being a musician. Like I've all, it's the, it's to me, well, most musicians will say the same thing. It's less of a job than a vocation. It's like, it's who you're going to be no matter what. You know, you're a musician. You don't have to be a professional musician. If you're a musician, it's just, it's what
It's
you
written
do.
in your
It's,
stars. Yeah.
yeah, you create music. It's a form of communication, you know, and it's, and like this guy Leon Russell that I wrote about, it was his primary form of communication. He couldn't really communicate well otherwise, and that's true for a lot of musicians. It's true for Rick Ocasek, who I'm writing about, I think now, although he was well better, but more easily, more easygoing, and well, I'm now I'm stumbling on words for trying to figure out how good he is at words. The irony. But you know, yeah, and then I think I always wanted to write as well. I wasn't a gigantic reader like you see, you hear about people that were like, my one of my brothers just was always reading a couple books. For me, it was like, you know, I was a moderate reader. I've always loved reading, but the I always I guess I've always been looking for a means of expression, and I was really interested. The more that we were creating music, the more I wanted to articulate how fun and rewarding the process is. And the more we made records, the more attuned my ears became to other people's records. Like, oh, they're using a mellotron here, or they're using a 12-string guitar, or, and oh, this is why. Oh, you know, like I didn't know anything about bridges when I was, I just sometimes would write a bridge, but I didn't know what it was called, you know. So all the structures of songs, all that kind of stuff, I want, and I loved hearing the stories from engineers and producers about other musicians. So I love that idea of being able to articulate what goes into making records and things. So that's what drew me to writing about music.
And when did you actually start learning how to play guitar?
Yeah, I started out on trumpet, you know, as a kid.
Oh.
And I was kind of a natural at it, honestly. I you know, I did pretty well and got like first chair or whatever it was called, and went to, you know, different regional things, and I was into it. I regret that I ever put it down, because now I want to be Chet Baker, or if not Miles Davis, you know.
Hell yeah.
But you know, it became not very cool at a certain point, marching band, you know. So when I was a kid. So guitar, my mother gave me a guitar without me even asking for it when I was like 11 or 12, and I took a couple of lessons down at the local music store, and I was just hooked instantly. And you know, the guy that was teaching me was fantastic, because he wasn't one of these guys that says, all right, we're just going to start on the fundamentals. He's like, here's three chords, let's learn a song, you know, let's do Can't You See by Marshall Tucker, which was one of my favorite songs, you know. And then he's like, okay, start playing over it. I'm like, what? He's like, start playing some leads. I'm like, what? I don't know. He's like, here's a scale. And it just hooked me instantly. And like I said, I kind of had these natural musical tendencies. And so I was just like, it was like a fish to water. And within like a year or so, I formed a quote unquote band with some guys down the street, you know, like 13 years old.
What was the name of your first band?
Well, we were really into Southern rock. Let me preface it by that, by saying that we were like these little 12, 13-year-olds that were really into Skynyrd and Marshall Tucker and stuff. So we called it 200 Proof. We were well below the age of drinking. I was still only like 2 years out from drinking, let's put it that
And where was this, or where were you living at this point?
Long Island, New York,
Okay.
Huntington, Long Island, out on the North Shore of Long Island.
And then you moved to Boston at a certain point. Did you move there, like, you know, to for music and things like that, or was there another push that moved you to Boston?
No, I moved out when I was going into junior year of high school, because my father got a new career or job, whatever, up in Providence, Rhode Island. So Providence was the town we moved to. It's called Medfield, which is like equidistant between Boston and Providence, and it was a nice little town with great schools. And so my parents did their research, and it was honestly, not to get too into this off track, but I mean, it was, it really was a great thing for me, even though it was brutal to move during
At
high
that
school.
age, yeah.
Yeah, it was really, it was, I've never been as depressed as I was that first half a year, at least, if not a year. And but I made these friends who are texting me now, you know, so it's like these lifelong friends. And I never lost the friends that I was dear to and my fellow musicians. I'm talking to one of them tonight, in fact, from Huntington. So that stuff is really important to me, those connections and the loyalties. But at the school, I went from this big school where I could get lost and you know, sort of hide, to a little school where I couldn't hide. And it probably saved me, because I was at best a middling student. And from there, a bunch of us all went on to UMass Amherst, and that's where Buffalo Tom formed.
So how did you meet the other guys in Buffalo Tom? I mean, you were obviously at the university, but how did that meeting
Yeah, it's
happen?
interesting. So Chris is also from Medfield and had also lived in Huntington at one point in his life. His father moved around. So I knew about Chris, but he was 2 years and remains 2 years older than me. I remind him all the time. So he was already at college. He had started at UMass Amherst from Medfield. It was like kind of a very common thing for people to go to UMass Amherst. Nowadays, it's really competitive to get into that school. But back then, it was great. It still is. It's an amazing bargain now. So anyway, Chris was there. He was playing around with some sort of party bands and different things. And but I when I was like a senior in high school, a lot of my friends who were a year ahead of me, 2 years ahead of me, were up at UMass. So I'd go up there and visit them. And I met this guy, Tom McGinnis. In fact, I met Tom McGinnis before I went to Amherst. He was going there as well. But my friends who had come back for like the first winter break from their freshman year said, "Oh, we met this guy. They have this band. They're playing up in Andover, Massachusetts," which was about maybe less than an hour drive from where we were, but about 45 minutes or so. So we all on Christmas break went up to Tom's house, and he was playing in his band with his cousin, who was the lead singer. And Tom was a bass player at that time. Tom went from guitar to bass, and then from bass to drums with Buffalo Tom. But they were this amazing band. I still love them. Still love their music. It was like they were high school, well, not college kids at this point, making original music, and it was like this artsy post-punk. I mean, they were definitely playing some punk rock as well, but they were playing like really inventive. Like they did like Hendrix covers, but it was like there was something very Bowie, Cure. Echo and the Bunnymen about, because this guy could sing, you know, he could really, his name was Phil Rattel, and he sings on our first record. In fact, he sings backing vocals on Flushing Stars. So anyway, they
Wow.
made a big impact on me, because I was starting to write songs, but they were mostly silly, jokey, you know, Dead Milkmen type punk rock songs.
That's
And
nothing wrong with that.
yeah, and or overly earnest bad poetry songs. So seeing them really sort of like, I was really, and plus I was, Tom still is handsome, but he was like a strikingly handsome guy with his hair, you know, the whole 80s hair in his eyes thing, and very taciturn and enigmatic. And and then I met Chris up at UMass, and so, and all of those things, it's like we always sort of wanted to be in a band together, I think. Or But they were doing different things I was doing. So it took us until I went to school in 84, in the winter of 86. So I mean, the first semester of my junior year is when Buffalo Tom formed and started playing at parties and stuff around there, playing, you know, opening shows for like Dinosaur Jr. and things like that.
So when did you first meet Jay Maskus, like Dinosaur Jr.? He was in the Amherst area. Is that right?
Yeah, Jay grew up there, and he was grew up in town in Amherst, and went to school at UMass for at least some of it. I don't know if he ever finished, but you want to talk about enigmatic? I mean,
Right.
I was a senior in high school, visiting my friends up there, and my friend Jay Talerman, who took some photos that are on the artwork of that first Dinosaur record. There's a guy in the sun. His name is Artie, and Jay took that photo of Artie. And so Jay introduced. We ran. I was with Jay. We were going through like the campus center or whatever. And there's Jay, who back then had more of a Nick Cave. You've probably seen early photos of him. He had kind of this like Nick Cave in the Birthday Party look, with this
Yes.
extreme spiky hair and beads. And he was a scrawny guy, and he didn't he barely said a word, but I was really struck by his presence as well. I mean, there are certain people that have this very quiet charisma, and Jay has that. He draws people in. He could be a cult leader, you know?
He's a man of little words, but
He's the people that say the fewest words, which I'm not one, hold the most power, you know?
I'm with you on that. I am with you on the talkativeness there.
So is that how you got the SST connection? Was it from Dinosaur Jr. or was that another connection?
Yeah, I think it was Jay. I mean, I remember going down to, you know, there was used to be the CMJ festival in New York, the convention really. It was like a, you know, the College Music Journal was, it was a tip sheet. And so it was kind of a big deal. It was sort of like South by Southwest before South by Southwest even became a bigger thing, if I guess it was around. But CMJ was a big deal. So we went down to CMJ. We had already signed to this Dutch label, but we didn't have US distribution yet or rights or whatever. So I remember sitting with Buffalo Tom and Jay and Greg Ginn from SST and Black Flag, who I had seen, you know, Black Flag, and that alone, that again, another weirdly enigmatic guy who didn't say much. But we were at some place, and Greg's like, "Yeah, so you guys want to put out the record?" And you're like, "Well, I guess SST." I mean, he's like, "Yeah, I'll put it out." You know, it's like, I think it was kind of the Jay connection, and I think it's interesting because I think Dinosaur Jr. were, if they hadn't already moved on from SST, they were in the pro. I guess not yet, because they put out Bug on SST, I think. So I think they were still on SST.
Yeah, and honestly, like we were saying before in the earlier part, you know, SST at that time was the label. They had the catalog that you could order, and it just had, you could almost just go through and pick a band by a name and know it was going to be a good band.
Yeah, I mean the labels that were like that for us were like Slash Records, and I mean I liked almost everything on Slash, and then there was
Or eight.
Homestead, which is what Jay was on, that became, you know, sort of like moved into Matador Records. Sub Pop, I don't think were quite around yet, or at least hadn't made an impact on me, I think, by that point. Maybe they were. I think that Love Buzz single came out in like 84. 687 from Nirvana, and I remember hearing that and knowing about, and Mudhoney came out first, so yeah, so the Mudhoney, it was around the same time, I guess, but SST had been making an impact, a bigger impact at least on me, you know. Sonic Youth, Husker Du, I mean, those Husker Du records came out in Black Flag when I was in high school, so that stuff was huge to me.
Yeah, that made me think too. So you were saying earlier, as you said, you grew up on, you know, Beatles, Stones, Led Zeppelin, things like that,
And Southern Rock.
and Southern rock. Some Marshall Tucker and
Skinnerd.
Skinner,
Leonard.
yeah, and yeah. Anyway, so at what point did you find, like, I don't know, punk rock or, you know, music that was different that made you kind of opened your eyes to say, "Wow, you know, there's something different out there, and maybe I can be part of this," you know, like, because it's more
Yeah,
DIY,
well,
whatever.
pretty early on, I was never like into like US hardcore punk too much, you know, like some of it. Black Flag to some extent, Circle Jerks. I mean, there was some funny stuff that appealed to me, and it was like this irreverence. But I mean, before that, you know, New York FM radio was both I think it became more conservative l later, but back then it was still the progressive FM kind of 70s mind, you know. So there were these stations, WPLJ, WNEW, but specifically WLIR out on Long Island, which had always been progressive. They were one of the first ones to sort of break Southern rock, in fact. But they used to have like Gram Parsons on and doing live stuff. And Van Morrison has a famous live thing that he did for LIR that's still out there. So they were a big station because they were playing not just like, they would play Southern rock, but then it was like really freewheeling. Like then you'd hear Patti Smith and Elvis Costello. And so it was that. And of course, the Ramones being in New York, you'd hear the Ramones and Graham Parker. I remember hearing like a lot of pub rock stuff. So that's the kind of, it was song oriented new music that really appealed to me. But I remember them breaking Talking Heads pretty big back then, in New York, like hearing Psycho Killer and then later, like, you know, Take Me to the River or whatever, and buying 77 and those records. I remember, so I had an uncle who lived in New York, down near CB, around the corner from CB's, in fact, when I was still that age, like 14 or so. And he bought me, well, it was his partner, actually, I found out later, who picked out the records, which were Remain in Light by Talking Heads, the U2's first record that nobody had heard of yet. It was whatever, 81. 81, I guess. And what was the other one? Oh, Nina Hagen, this Nina Hagen EP.
Oh,
Yes.
wow. I love
And the Nina
Nina
Hagen
Hagen.
EP was really striking because she was like, you know, I later found out, oh, she's just but it was like this East German model that had become a punk rocker, you know. A lot of these sort of models became punk rockers, not a lot, but a few, like Baby Buell or whatever. But it was a cool, I guess my records are over there, but it's like a 10-inch really punk rock record. And of course, Sex Pistols. I mean, everybody knew the Sex Pistols record because they made such a big splash. And I liked that record so much because it was just rock and roll. It was like the Ramones. It was like, I don't know, you call this punk rock, I guess. But
Yeah.
you know, but it was later, it, you know, when I was, but I was listening to a lot of weird, like I was very eclectic, you know, because of the Stones and all that stuff. I went deeper into blues, like a lot of people did, especially guitar players. And there were some great blues shows down in New York on, there's a Stony Brook college or university station that was playing country blues. And I still have these cassettes that I made of this guy's show over and over and over again. That's how I got into Lightnin' Hopkins and all that stuff. So I'm rambling now, but like when you know, coming back to Slash Records, like when Gun Club came out and did like Robert
Yeah.
Johnson songs or whatever else, I was like, amazing. Like, this is like combining punk rock with the blues, or so overtly was like, and that was one of the bands that brought Buffalo Tom together. Chris and I were gigantic Gun Club fans, and it was really spooky, weird stuff for us, you know. Like, who are these guys? You know, again, coming back to Enigma and Jeffrey Lee Pierce and all that stuff. So, but yeah, moving to Massachusetts was a big deal because there were so many college stations. And, you know, I was in this shitty little, let me back up, because first of all, I shouldn't swear on the FCC stations.
We can, this isn't live, so we can edit this stuff, so you're good.
I know it's not live. But it was this beautiful little rural town, but it was like in the middle of nowhere with nothing going on. But you know, it had its contingent of people that were really into new stuff, new music, and including all my friends that I mentioned. And but there were these college stations that really kind of saved my sanity, because I learned about so many new bands from there, from the DBs to the Jam to whatever else was happening, that I just went out immediately, including jazz records. I would go out, I would, you know, my mother would be driving to the mall or whatever, or friends would be getting onto the T to go into the metro, whatever you call it, to go into Boston to Newbury Comics, which is a famous record store, punk rock record store. And I remember going out because I heard the first, well, I heard Power, Corruption, and Lies, you know, from New Order, Age of Consent. I'm like, this is mind blowing, this song, whatever this is. I
Yes.
have to go find this, you know. And so it was those revelations. It was that discovery, it was going to Boston, I think, that really opened the doors for me.
What was the first Buffalo Tom song written?
Well,
Or that at
some of
least
them,
made it to an album?
yeah, some of them, well, some of that first record were carried over from songs I was writing before Buffalo Tom formed. So I think I wrote Impossible when I was still like, maybe my freshman year of college, but maybe earlier, even high school. And it's got a kind of a juvenile lyric. But The Bus is one that I had written the summer before Buffalo Tom formed. I was living in New York for the summer. My uncle, who gave me those records for my birthday, he gave me a job down there. And I've written about this because he was a really, he was like a pivotal mentor in my life. And so he gave me this job working. He was working at this corporate job at Citicorp. And I was just doing some data entries. Anyway, I was down there for a summer. I mentioned this guy I'm going to talk to tonight. I was living with him in this single room occupancy hotel up on 99th Street, and it stared down to Broadway. I mean, it opened the there's a line in that song. I stared down at the Broadway. We were on Broadway on 99th, and it was just a very ruminative lyric about just being alone. Staring out the window, and a day or two in the life of me going through New York City. I mentioned Billie Holiday. I bought a Billie
Yeah.
Holiday tape at a flea market down there. So
You
that was all
listen
sort of,
to Billie Holiday. Yeah.
yeah, true story. As it turns out, true story.
Speaking of lyrics,
Wait, what's our time limit? 'Cause I saw it just popped up and said we're
yeah,
getting close to the 40.
we've got 9 minutes, but we can start this over if that's at the after 9 minutes, if that's okay with you,
Sure.
or if you're unless you're pressed for time, but
No, no problem.
we'd like to keep talking if that's okay with
Yeah,
you.
absolutely.
All right. Okay, cool. All right. So speaking of lyrics, so and if it's okay to talk about, you said you're working on a book about the Cars, right? And this would be your fourth book, is that correct?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. All right. So was it a major transition going from, because you're obviously writing lyrics, so going from a lyricist to an author, was that a huge jump? Or I mean, as far as, or was it a natural progression?
I think they're different things, almost completely different things. In fact, you know, I there was when Buffalo Tom were really kind of getting going, I was reading and writing poetry. Like I took a class with James Tate up at UMass Amherst, who Joe Pernice from the Pernice Brothers also took classes with, and I think David Berman from the Silver Jews. Those guys. Joe and Joe was a friend of mine since undergrad school there, but I didn't meet David until later. He came to get his MFA after I had left. But I think we all took these classes, and they took advanced classes. I took an intro class with James Tate, who was a famous poet who got the Pulitzer Prize, and I wrote, you know, very poor poetry, but it got me in the sort of realm into that, you know, and the more you write, the more you read, the more you read, the more you write. When this is true of anything, any kind of style of writing. In fact, it's interesting in doing the Leon book, T-Bone Burnett, the producer, told me about that he was told during that project that he did with Leon Russell and Elton John that Bernie Late, I'm sorry, not Bernie Late, Bernie Taupin, who is Elton's lyricist, would often, if not, I guess often, I guess, write lyrics to an existing song. And then he would take those lyrics, independent of the song, of course, and give them to Elton. So they were written in a meter and a rhyme and a scheme and a, you know, sort of a pattern that Elton could then imagine new music for.
That's
And
interesting. That's interesting.
yeah, it's one of those exercises, and the reason I bring it up is just jumped to my mind, but it's a different kind of, it's almost like a kind of different muscle when you're writing songs and poetry, and then poetry from songs, because poetry you want to stand alone on a page, and sometimes it's just very often it's just blank verse with no scheme or whatever. So from there to writing prose is it's almost like, you know, apples and oranges. It's I try to inject some poetry into my prose, but rarely the opposite. You know, it songs and like songs exist independent of poetry because the lyrics are not meant to be standing alone on a page, which is why I never print lyrics in our records. I think that the music and the it's like to try to separate them out is sort of defeats the purpose. It's, I mean, many people's lyrics can stand alone on the page, including like Bob Dylan or whoever else, but it doesn't, it's not the same impact. It's not meant to be separated from the music. That they're supposed to work in conjunction. So
And
anyway,
it's good for us fans that you are easy to understand.
I'm not sure that I am, but thank you. I mean, a lot of, especially those early songs are very oblique, I think. And it's funny, I'm writing about the Cars, as we say, and Rick Ocasek's lyrics were very often, most often, oblique and specific, weird little imagery and surreal stuff, and not necessarily any kind of I'm writing a song about X kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I think oblique is kind of why we were drawn to Buffalo Tom at an early age, like in our early 20s or especially early 90s. You know, there was times were much different, and we were talking about Maya used to make, oh, I think we all made mixtapes at the time because that was the only choice before CDs. I don't know, were you a mixtape kind of guy? Did you make mixtapes for
Yeah.
other people or?
Yeah, and the stuff that I loved was oblique too. I mean, from REM and to later Pavement or whatever. Mixtapes were a big part of my life, and still I still make playlists, and it's I still approach playlists like I did mixtapes. Like I try to create this arc and these relationships between the songs, and I don't just throw a bunch of songs that I'm listening to onto a thing, in fact, I mean, I've always loved listening to music more that way too. I like we would be in the van with Buffalo Tom, and I'd rather listen to mixtapes than a whole album at a time. And like very often we'd put the same, and then later CDs, we'd put CDs on, and I'm like, didn't we just listen to this? Like, I would rather listen to a variety of things. You know, there's, I mean, certain records you want to listen to from start to finish, and you can't imagine not listening to them start to finish. But you know, my listening habits tend to be like to a fault almost. Like, you know, I'll listen to this. Like my daughter will send me songs that oh man, I love that song. I'll put it onto a playlist, and then I was like, then that playlist will come back. And I'm like, man, I should have dove deeper into this band. Like, what else is going on with this band? You
But
know, I only.
that's a thing of this age now, though. And I talk about this on the radio as a DJ, how people don't have that time that we did back then to really like envelop an album because there's so much new music coming out and coming at us, you know, constantly that you don't always have that time to really sit and like deep dive into a band or into an album.
Yeah, well, I don't feel like I do. I mean, I do sometimes. And I buy vinyl, and when I do buy vinyl, I put on a whole record
Oh,
and
yeah.
listen to it that way. But it takes time and to immerse yourself, as you say. But like my kids, I know they listen to some of the same records over and over again. So, in total, you know, from start to finish. On Spotify or whatever. But I think it's more about like where you are with your life, you know, like if you don't have the time, or if your brain works in a certain way. I mean, you know, the album age will be, you know, I mean, human existence will be a blip in the universe, right? But within that like little subset of recorded music, it will be like the golden age of the album will have been what, 20 years, 30 years maximum, right? From like the mid 60s to maybe the mid 90s. And then it started to go back to songs again, which is what it was before, kind of just, you know.
Okay, well, I hate to stop you there. So we're down to a minute and a half on the recording. So I'm gonna end this call and then I'll send you another invite. Is
Okay.
that cool? Okay, thank you.
Sounds good.
All right, thank you. Sorry about that.
Oops.
We just took a little break.
All right.
All right. And we're back. All right, so what were we talking about?
So we said we were kind of like finishing up that conversation
Oh.
about music
Oh.
then in the days and
Vinyl.
yeah,
And
vinyl.
yeah. Do you still collect a lot of records? I mean, how compared to, well, actually back in the day you didn't have a choice, but you said you still collect vinyl.
Yeah, I'm sorry. One second. Let me just. I just got this
Okay.
work thing. Hold on.
Yeah. No
Let me
problem.
just.
We're
Let me
taking
just
up your.
take him back. Text him back.
Okay, you're fine.
Okay. Yeah. In terms of vinyl, I don't. I'm not a huge collector, and I took a lot of years off. And I like streaming. I know it comes with a lot of deals with the devil kind of stuff. But as a fan, it's hard to argue with it. And I've got good listening systems and stuff. So There are, I don't want to delve too deep into that. I mean, there are pluses to minuses on not just on the as a consumer, but as a musician. It could always be better, and it could have always been better for musicians. It was never great for musicians, so it wasn't like there was this Shangri-La beforehand. And honestly, most of the vinyl I buy is used stuff, so it's not going to the artist. I mean, when I go to a show, or if there's a young band that grabs me, like Big Thief or whoever else, I go out and buy the vinyl, or I order it from their website or Bandcamp, and I'm very conscious of supporting artists that are out there doing it. And but yeah, I listen to, like, the last vinyl I always, like, when I'm writing a book, for example, I go deep into the vinyl copies for research, and just to have them to remind me of the time I was writing about the book or whatever. So I've got many editions of the Cars records right now. I've got all the Leon records and side projects, and that stuff is really, as a collector, like, I'm not like a big collector. Like, I don't need, like, I'm not a completist, and I don't need certain editions and blah blah blah. I think that stuff is fun, but it's just not where my energy gets off on,
Right.
And the one thing I wanted to ask, if in your collection, do you have an album that would be like, if you're not like the collector, do you have an album though that you're really glad that you do have?
Oh, plenty. Yeah. I mean, I have some rare records, but I wasn't, like, looking for rare records. And like, one of the rare records, I actually wrote about this on my website. It's a funny, weird little story about me falling into this record from a client of my day job. Was getting rid of his parents' records, and there was this record, I can't even remember the name of it. But I just looked it up because I was more curious about, like, what is this record? It looked like a Paisley Underground type record, or but it was a real 60s record from these kids. It's big, it, record collectors will know maybe immediately of what I'm talking about, because it was like sort of a holy grail. It was one of these, like, vanity pressings of this really cool band that formed up at Phillips Academy, elite private school of the bushes at all, up in Andover. So I was looking up to see if these guys were still around, like, and then I came across Discogs and saw that these records were like $3,000-$4,000. So,
Wow.
and it was the, I told the client, I said, look, he knew nothing about this record. He said, oh no, keep it. But I sold it, because I'm like, I don't, what do I know? It's on Spotify. I'll sell it and give the money back to them. They didn't want the money, it turns out. But it was a cool story, because I wrote about it, because I did get in touch with one or two of the guys, and I said, man, I had no idea. And it was in mint condition. It had probably rarely ever been played. So I would rather have people that, for whom that means a lot, have those records, because I don't want to be responsible for one of those things sitting in my flood mildew basement, but yeah, like, all the records I bought when I was a kid, I'm glad to have. But I'm, in terms of, like, as a collector, yeah, I mean, all the original Red Label mono Stones records I got when I was a kid, Highway 61 in mono, and big thick wax, or shellac. I love those records. I love the pink vinyl copy I bought when I was a kid of Zeppelin 4. And I mean, I've got a I'm sure, like, I can think of 100 records that I have that are like that. But nothing that I'm like, oh, I got this, and look, it's worth all this. I mean, I do have this. I every once in a while I'll look up to see what a certain record is going for. I'm like, whoa, I can't believe that this record I have is going for that.
For me and my vinyl collection, it's not so much how much the album is worth. It's more of its worth for me. What is that prized album that I am so glad that is in my collection? So that's how I look at it.
And so any of those records I bought in my prime, buying, or, like, early, especially record days, they all tell stories, right? And that's what everybody, it's like kind of a cliche, but I mean, and that kind of gets back to what I'm talking about. Like, I want to buy records that mean something to me, like, so writing these books, or my first records, my first Beatles records, and those records I mentioned that my uncle got me. Those kinds of stories, we attach them, and that's where the physical manifestation of this stuff means so much. And yeah, it's I grieve the loss of that. I'm glad it sort of hasn't completely gone. And I love going to record stores. I have friends that own record stores that I but it's dangerous for me. Same thing with bookstores. It's like, I'm going to come home with four books that I'm just going to put on a pile and hope to read within the next 10 years, before I die. So,
Speaking of books, who are some of your favorite authors?
well, in terms of music, I'm looking at this book right now. Nick Tosh's Hellfire, about it's about Jerry Lee Lewis. I just love Tosh's writing. He's not for everybody that want their music writing, more reportive. He's more of like a almost like a novelist. He did one on Dean Martin as well, called Dino, and he did one on country music, which I haven't read. So I mean, he's on one extreme. Grail Marcus is sort of over there sometimes too, but I don't love Grail as much as Nick. And then you've got, like, on the other side, I mean, I'm looking at Warren Zane's Petty book, which I love as well. I love Warren's writing. I love his new book on Nebraska, which is one of my favorite records, especially buying, the one of those vinyl records that meant so much to me. I love Jimmy McDonough's writing. These are all music writers, and one of my heroes is Peter Guralnick, who's on the other side of the extreme, much more sort of reportive, dispassionate, maybe. I'm not even sure if that's actually accurate. But as far as fiction goes, I like guys and people like Richard Ford, Carver, Raymond Carver. I mean, those are the names that always jump to my mind. More contemporary fiction, but I go back. I haven't read much fiction over the last few years, unfortunately. My wife reads a new book every few days or a week at max, and she's in a book club. And so I'm just like, I kind of got to let that stuff go by me, because I've got to delve into research, and I've got so many music books that people send me. I'm just looking at my shelves now, again, it's those piles that I hope to get to at some point. But when I see a Richard Ford book, it's like he was like one of my favorite. He was my favorite probably author for a while, and I just haven't even gotten to. I didn't even know he had one out recently called Be Mine. But yeah, I mean, there's some great music writers, and I don't want to leave them all out, but I'm doing so now.
So when can we expect to see this new Cars book out?
I think late 24, early 25 might
Oh,
be more
okay.
realistic. I mean, I'm going to be mostly done with it by summer, I think, or
So you're
sometime over
pretty
this.
much already like you're in the middle of it or
I'm
kind of
in
in
the
the
middle of it. Yeah, I'm sort of, I'm, you know, I kind I, the way I write these books is, and I haven't written many of, I wrote the bio of Leon, and this is a band bio. The other books weren't so much bios, the two books on the Stones. This one is less intensive in terms of the amount of interviews. I did 130, 140 interviews for Leon. This one, I've got the three, but he wasn't around, and
Yeah.
I had to get as many. And he touched. He was around for six, 7 decades of music or something. So with these guys, it was a shorter window, and three of them are still with us. So I'm. It's a whole different thing. I tend to research. Write research kind of as I'm going along, all at once, backfilling or correcting as I go, just to sort of, the research leads me to write, the writing leads me to research, the interviews sort of color it all out, right? That's kind of how it's working with this one. So I'm pretty deep into the chronology already on this one.
And do you have any a tour set for either your books and doing book signings, and then of course with Buffalo Tom and the new album?
No, nothing is set. We're looking at dates right now. Nothing's been announced. I mean, the bookstore, there's no real, I don't do book tours. I
Okay.
would, but it's the publishing industry is like, well, you could do a few events, but it's not like the old days where you went barnstorming from town to town and all these bookstores. It's a whole different thing now, but I do like doing book events. But I don't go out on the road for an extended period of time. I'll pop down to New York or whatever. The band tour, I think we're finally loosening up with our schedules. You know, our kids are all no longer kids, and our partners and spouses don't really care that if we're gone for now. In fact, they'd be like, yeah, please go. But I it's more the day job stuff, and like, you know, how far can we push that? You know, if we were a full-time band, yeah, we'd go out for a month or more at a time, maybe. I don't know. But I mean, the reason that we're not a full-time band is because we got so tired of that life,
Yeah.
and trying to make a living by just being on the road is no way to live for some people. For some people, it's their ideal life for a Willie Nelson. Not that he needs to. I think we'll, to answer your question, we'll do what we did on our last record, which came out in 17 or 18, which is like, you know, we go and do a couple of shows in the Midwest, and then we'll go down through the West Coast a little bit. And then, you know, certainly we hit the East Coast whenever we can, sort of more from home base. And then we always go to Europe and do some shows there because it's much more, the like we're per capita we're the biggest, we in the smallest country, you know, Belgium. So but we play to like 3,000 people headlining in Belgium, you know, or something like that. So which is not gigantic, but it's for us, it's better than 300 you know, in Austin or whatever. I think we'll do okay in Austin too, but I hope to get to Austin. I mean, there's so many places I want to go to play
That
and
was one of my
to see.
questions. I was wondering if there is still some places that you really want to still go and see and play in.
Yeah, and there's places that we haven't been to in decades. You know, I've been back to Italy as a tourist, and I prefer doing, it's different, you know, it's different. Like going with my family to Italy is wonderful and amazing, but it's different than going with a band where you're not being the tourist. You're hopefully you get one day in one place. So, but we haven't been back there since the 90s to play. So I'd love to, but it's, I don't know. It's, you know, the economics of this stuff, and the tour logistics and infrastructure, all that stuff matters, especially as you get older. Back then, it would be like, I don't know, some guy would book, I don't know, you guys want to go down there? There's this promoter there that says he'll have you. They'll string together dates. You make, you know, very little money, and but you come home hopefully broken even, and you had a great time. You know, when you were young, that was great. I mean, I have this fax that I've kept. I mean, I kept a lot of this stuff. I didn't keep it because of this, but it's from that promoter that I was sort of just referencing there. This, you know, one of our first promoters, he said, hey, it was like our second, it would be for our second European tour, I think. I'm not even sure if that's right. One of our early tours. And it said, hey, Nirvana, can't do these dates anymore. This whole tour, does Buffalo Tom want this? And because it was because Nirvana had just broken big on Nevermind, and so they moved up to big venues, and Buffalo Tom was like inheriting the scraps from Nirvana. And yeah, but it's this really cool little cultural artifact, I think, you know, for us. But yeah, there's so many places I would love to go just in the world, period. Playing music is a really cool way to do it because you don't get to do the touristy stuff much. If you're lucky, you get to pop into a museum half, you know, one morning. But you get to meet people and really get to know some people, like some of my dearest friends, Betty Severd or whoever else, like these bands that we see that we met back in the 90s, and we go to their houses and have dinner with them in Amsterdam or in London or wherever we are, like to go see friends that come see us in Scotland. And that stuff is extremely meaningful to me, and to us, as a band. Like, and we have a friend who travels with us just because that's the way he knows it's a great way to travel. So he's gonna. His name is Paul. He's a headhunter. He can work from anywhere at any time. And so he goes with us and he just hangs out. And because he's like meeting all these people that you don't get to meet as a tourist, you know?
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the new album. This will be your 10th studio album. And I'm extremely excited. And the new single comes out this Friday, the 12th of January, called Helmet. And the new album, what's the title of the new album?
Jump Rope.
Jump. And that, do you have an official release date yet, or is this spring of
It's in
2024?
May sometime.
Hey.
I just let our team know that we have like a project manager and a publicist and stuff. And if you want to get in contact with them, they'll help out
Okay.
with those sort of specifics.
Yeah, we'd like to get some early radio play if we if possible. But yeah,
What's
and
the new single about?
I don't really kind of get into what things are about because we talked earlier about why we like certain oblique lyrics, and I don't write songs to say, okay, I just wanted to write this song so I could talk about what this mean, what this means. Like, that's pretty much what it means is what I wrote. Like, I have nothing more to say on that topic. That said, it's got sort of a big allegory going on there for me. That's what it means to me. But I don't want to kind of impart my meaning on of the song if somebody else has a more interesting perspective on it, what it means to them.
I like that. Leaving it up to the listener.
So real quickly, I mean, been a huge fan since the first album, and love everything you've done. Want to talk briefly about the recording session you did mid-90s for the Schoolhouse Rock Rocks album when you guys did Lolly Lolly Lolly, Get Your Adverbs Here. What was that session like?
The session, well, I remember them asking us to if we wanted to do it. It was sort of this era of a lot of compilation type, tribute type records. And it was sort of our generation, like that was such a Schoolhouse Rocks was like everybody knew it. It meant so much to everybody. And not just, it was like a musical thing. It was like those songs mean a lot to us just as music, never mind the messages and learning method, and it was that era of like really cool, Sesame Street into this, into Zoom, and like different ways of learning on public television. This was obviously commercial television. It was during cartoons, and the cartoons were great. Anyway, I remember like jumping at it and going, yeah, we'll do it. Just like all those other bands that said it. And I couldn't believe that that song was still available. Usually we have to go down to our third choice. They're like, oh, sorry, Pearl Jam took a while. Whatever. The session, I remember, I don't remember much. I remember Chris doing the squirrel voice on it, though. I remember like saying, like being ridiculous, like he'd do it and we'd like be behind the glass going, Chris, could you bring a little bit more squirrel emotion into that? I'm not really, I mean, great. That's a great first take, but,
No, it was a great version. Did you get, I mean, I guess it'd be impossible to perform that live with all the background things going on in the song.
No, I mean, I think we were happy to do it once. We didn't really want to reprise I mean, it's funny. We did this new theme song for an NBC television show called Extended Family, and it's been on, I think, might be having its third episode tonight. A friend of ours is the showrunner, Mike O'Malley, and John Cryer is in it, and he said, "Hey, Mike loves Mike did this Mike was an actor on Yes, Dear too with Anthony Clark, and that was about 10 years ago or so, and that was on for a long time, and he asked me to do he wasn't the showrunner on that. He said, but they're looking for a song that like the old 70s or 80s show sitcoms where the song tells you a little bit about the show, and so he tasked me with that back then, and then he tasked us with this one where he's the showrunner, and this is all a long story, but by way of saying that, we wrote like a 30-second song, and people are like, I really like that song. Is that going to be released? And are you going to play this live? And I mean, all we have is 30 seconds. We just wrote it for the television show. But I will say that it was this sort of idea of a song. Like when he asked me to write, when he asked us to write it, because we were in the studio at the time with Buffalo Tom, I said, well, we just happened to be in the studio. I said, how about this idea? And it was kind of a fragment of an idea of a song that I would have developed into something probably like the melody and the chords, but the lyrics were all like for the show. And I didn't develop it past like a verse and a chorus. And of course, then even then, I don't, writing for TV, it's like you get endless notes. You have to keep going back in and changing a word. You have to word, you have to go into, and you have to bring sort of like bringing the squirrel emotion again to one word. And that's great. Hey, listen, can you go back in the studio and change? We need you. This one sounds a little too negative. Can you? It's like I can't imagine doing it for a living, although. As a musician, it's one of the few lucrative ways to make any kind of dough is to write for television.
Yeah. Well, I will have to go and find this because I do theme songs. Like I'll do
Oh, you
blocks
do?
of theme songs on my
Oh, you play.
show. So I will totally have to put this in with my theme song blocks.
Oh, yeah. It's
All 30
look at
seconds.
Buffalo Tom's social somewhere along the line. We posted it in the last couple of weeks. It debuted on 26th or 27th of December, I think,
I
Saturday
thought
night.
I
And
saw something come through on Facebook or something about that.
yeah, you can hear the song. It's out there.
That's awesome. You were talking about touring and playing songs. Tom asked, if you did the Lolly Lolly song, do you have a favorite Buffalo Tom song that you like to perform?
I have a lot of Buffalo Tom songs that I can't imagine not performing. And they're always in the set list pretty much, like Larry, and I'm Allowed and Tail Lights Fade and Soda Jerk and Treehouse. I mean, those kinds of songs all mean a lot to me. I couldn't tell you, no, I don't. I mean, usually, of course, we love to try to play the new songs because, and I say emphasis on try, it's a challenge, and anybody that's doing something from muscle memory, a lot of it, and that's not to say that we're turned off from the emotion, but so much of it's instinctual, and the muscle memory can be a really beautiful thing, is a really beautiful thing because it allows you to sort of trust that you can, the band's going to all be doing this thing while you try maybe something new, because that's the beauty of playing live is to not just sort of try to execute it perfectly every time. It's like, where does it take you? And so doing new songs though is like it puts you on your adrenaline system on notice. It's like everything is amped up, and you're like you're all tr hoping the other guys don't mess up. You're hoping you don't mess up, and it's like this edgier thing. It kind of brings you alive a little bit. So, no, I mean, I love pulling out some old songs like we've been doing the like we're playing in New York this weekend. We played in Boston a few weeks ago, actually at the beginning of December, and we pulled out the song "Do You In," which is a Buffalo Tom track from I think it was from Smitten, and it's not a song we had done a ton after that record, so I like revisiting songs.
As the fan, that I love that. I love when you pull a song out that hasn't been played a whole lot live, but it's a deep track and it possibly could be one of your absolute favorites, and you just bust out with that. It's fantastic.
Yeah, as a fan, I'm like that too. Like I, like Chris and I, and other Stones fans that are diehard Stones fans, is like, come on, guys, do you really need to do this again? And they do, and I understand that as a band. It's like, do you need to do "Start Me Up" or "Satisfaction"? And people would be mad if they didn't do those, I guess. But I want to hear like "Winter" and "Coming Down Again" or "Let It Loose." These sort of deep tracks, and I don't know. It's just unrealistic, I think. But then they do it. Then you've
Right.
got guys like you've got Chuck Lavelle encouraging them in the band to do that. And yeah, it's good to mix it up. And it's funny. You end up like the Stones do. And I always compare us to the Stones. You come up with like slots. Like, oh, now here's the slot where we'll put in the wild card. Like we'll put in like we did "For All to See" in Boston a few weeks ago, and that was from
Nice.
yeah that was from one of those compilations, the No
Yeah.
Alternatives. So, and we loved playing that a lot.
Yeah, that was another one of those compilations you were talking about from the 90s. Like you did that in the Sweet Relief compilation, and I'm
Yeah, so
sure several.
those benefits, it's a nice way to give back something, right? Or to take part in something that's not just about music careerism or whatever. But then those things do boost your career. I mean,
Yes.
it's like
That's what I
a
was going to say. Yeah. That's an
yeah
easy
no
way to get your music out to people who might not have ever heard you.
right. I mean, No Alternative was one of those records. It turned on a whole generation to a bunch of different bands. Like they might have known Smashing Pumpkins, but did they know Goo Goo Dolls yet at that point? Goo Goo Dolls weren't famous yet,
Right.
big famous, I mean. And then a lot of people learned about Buffalo Tom from that and from of course, from My So-Called Life, the television show, which, you know, again, coming back to TV, that wasn't written for that, of course, but it was like we were in it and had, and the song played a, such a pivotal part. So for us, it was like that in particular, My So-Called Life, it's like we went from like a 90% dude audience to like, you know, more of a balanced guys and females, you know,
It
and
really
younger.
was pivotal in the episode. It was, I remember when watching that for the first time and was already a huge fan of yours. And when that came on, I was like, what? Oh my
Yeah, and they mentioned Buffalo Tom so much in the script, it's almost like we paid him a buck every time they said it or something. Yeah, are you going to the Buffalo Tom show? We're going to Buffalo Tom, Buffalo Tom, Buffalo Tom. It was like, whoa, our moms were impressed. Let's put it that way.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. Yeah, we're gonna have to kind of wrap this up, but yeah, so you're saying, so you're playing Bowery Ballroom on the 13th, this coming Saturday, and then hopefully more tour dates to follow. And you do have an open invitation to play Charleston, West Virginia.
Yes, you do. And to come to the WTSQ studios, hang out with Tom and I, and play some stuff live on the air.
That sounds good. I think I've been there.
Oh, yeah.
I know Buffalo Tom has played Charleston, but I think I went out there once solo to do something. But I believe it was that station. I mean, well, are there any other
We're
community?
new. Yeah,
Oh, okay, so it
we've
wasn't
only
this.
been here for, we're almost coming up on our 9th year.
Oh,
And
okay.
before that, there were no like small LP. We had no alternative stations.
Oh, and then it's probably
It
not that
could have
station.
been
Then
maybe
not there.
Charleston, South Carolina, too.
No.
Yeah, we get that confusion a lot.
But no, it's Buffalo Tom played Charleston way back. I couldn't even tell you the club, but it was like one of our. It was like when we were still crashing on people's floors because it was the first time I ate grits. Somebody made me grits in the morning.
I wonder if it was the empty glass.
Do some research.
It was the empty glass, probably. Yeah.
It probably was. That's one of our oldest bars,
World famous empty.
and it's one that a lot of musicians and things will play as kind of a money gig, like a
Yeah.
gas gig, and
Yeah.
because it's a quick, it's easy to get in there, and they have music 7 days a week.
Yeah, and we stayed out at some guy's. He was like renting a place with some other guys, and it was out on a farm outside on the outskirts of town somewhere. And it was, he's like, he cooked us grits in the morning. We're like, wow, thank you.
That's amazing. We're going to have to do our research and figure out who that was and where that was to
It
add to
would have been
this.
like 89, probably. So good luck.
Okay.
Yeah,
Right on.
We'll do our research.
So would you like to give any shout outs to anybody over the
no.
air? No. Okay. All right. Perfect. Perfect. Great. Good answer. All right.
Hey,
And
Barack Obama, if you're listening.
all right. And thank you. And all right, we'll cut that out. No. Anyway.
We'll keep Barack Obama.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And how can our listeners find out more about, Bill Janovitz, your projects and Buffalo Tom?
Oh, we're all over, and I'm particularly all over social media. So that's yeah, just find me on the Facebook, on the thread. I'm trying to divest as most sentient beings are trying to get off of X a bit. But Facebook and is we're always updating stuff over there and threads and Instagram and all that stuff.
That's awesome.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for.
Yes. Thank you so much for taking the
Thanks, guys.
time.
It was a great chat.
Yeah.
And Tom is going to see if we send you some wording for a couple station IDs. Could you record those and just send them over to us?
Yeah, no problem.
Perfect. Yeah, Tom will send that over to you. Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
All
Yeah,
right,
thanks,
thanks, guys.
Bill.
You
We'll
too.
have to do it again sometime.
All right, take
All
care.
right. Have a great day.
Bye
Thanks,
bye.
Bill.